Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 296, and we're going to talk about where things go. It's kind of a strange thing to talk about, but I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about your van and all the things in it. Where do they go? We're also going to talk about the best air filter that you can get for any van, and the answer might be a bit of a surprise. A tale from the road that is not my own, and it is in progress, but actually pretty interesting. And, whatever else comes up. Actually, there's a lot of stuff in this episode. And thank you for being here to listen to it. I appreciate it, and I'm happy to be back with you, and I apologize again for being a day late. Let's just face it, folks. The schedule is off. I've got so many things going on right now that I am constantly, every day, like, oh my God, what do I work on today? And it's weird. I don't know how my life gets like this. I have a lot of control over my schedule, but right now, things are crazy. And I'm going to tell you about two things that are making it a little bit crazy, which are actually opportunities for you if you're interested. Again, van life, cruising, different things, but I am actually organizing two different trips that are very different from your traditional cruise. In fact, they're not. One of them is to Antarctica on the Celebrity Equinox. This is a traditional cruise ship, but the trip itself is not traditional. It leaves from Buenos Aires, Argentina, in January of 2028, and it goes down to Ushuaia, which is the normal jumping off point for Antarctica, heads down to the peninsula, cruises around the peninsula and a bunch of islands, but you do not get off the ship. That is a very important thing. Then up to Elephant Island, cruises around there, then the Falkland Islands, and then it goes up to Puerto Madryn, where you can walk around with penguins, and then to Montevideo in Uruguay, which is a wonderful country, and then back to Buenos Aires. Takes a couple of weeks. It's not an inexpensive trip at all, but it is far, far less expensive than an Antarctic expedition. So if you are someone who wants to see Antarctica in the most comfort possible, because this larger ship is going to be able to navigate the Drake Passage easier than most, this is the way to do it. It saves money, it's a lot more comfortable, and you get to see all these things. But you do not get to set foot in Antarctica, which I have talked about in the past. What does that even mean? Is that important? That's a decision for you. Anyway, I do have a little bit of space left. This trip sold out very quickly. I think I've got a couple of outside cabins and a couple of more expensive balcony cabins left. But if you're interested, just let me know and I'll see what I can do for you. This is the kind of trip where if you want to see Antarctica, but you're worried about running out of time or it's going to get too expensive or whatever, you should take a look at this one. Now, I'm also doing, just suddenly, that I haven't talked about with you guys yet, back on Royal Clipper, the world's largest sailing vessel that's still in service, we are doing a round trip from Venice. And what's special about that is that this ship actually gets to sail the Grand Canal in Venice, while most other ships are prohibited. So you can imagine being on the world's largest sailing vessel in Venice and what that would be like. And then it goes down to Couture, Montenegro, with the amazing sail in there through the fjords. And then you can go up the hill or whatever. I've talked about Couture, the amazing city. Then it goes to Monopoli, which is actually a city in Italy. And then a couple of littler ports in Croatia, including Kres. And then back to Venice. That's a week-long trip. It's actually much less expensive than the Antarctica trip, but it is a completely different experience. I do not consider Royal Clipper trips to be like normal cruises, because they aren't. You're on a working ship. Everything on the ship is there for a reason. There's nothing performative, you know. There's no casinos. There's no Broadway shows. It's you and the ship and the crew, all part of this family going from port to port. Completely different experience. And I just announced this, and like more than half of the people that got off Royal Clipper with me before have signed up for this. Royal Clipper has an amazing rate of people that come back because that many people love it. So if you're interested in that, also drop me a note and we can talk about it. But at any rate, this is a van life podcast, not a boat life podcast. My life is just complex like that. And I want to offer you guys the same opportunities I offer everybody. And a few folks from the van life world have actually joined us on these trips and have enjoyed it. So, you know, there is an overlap. It's for people who love adventures and to travel. That said, Let's talk about where things go in your van. This is a shower idea I had. I was like, you know, it's kind of interesting to think about. We have a van, we spend a lot of time building it out, or we spend a lot of money buying one, whatever, but there's this object that we have in our lives, and for some of us, it's a very big part of our lives, and some of us, it's almost our entire lives. We are living in these vans full-time, or spending all our free time in them, whatever. It's an important thing. But it's very temporary. Most vans, 20 years from now, aren't going to exist. Pagurus, my first van that I built out is, let's see, that was a 2014 van, so it's 12 years old now. I no longer own it. It may not exist anymore. I actually don't know. All those hours I spent in there in cramped conditions, bleeding literally because I, you know, put a screw in wrong or whatever, what was it for? Well, it was for the experience of doing it. I have no regrets there, but it's interesting to think about where did all the stuff end up? So let's assume that that van is gone. Let's assume that whatever happened, maybe it just got too old, maybe it caught on fire, it was in an accident. I hope none of those things have happened, but whatever. Let's assume that it is gone. Where did the stuff go? And let's start at the bottom. So we're at the ground level. Van just rolls over on the ground. Starting at the bottom, first part that touches the ground is the tires. Where do tires go? You may have noticed that tires wear out over time. You know, they go on there and then they get smaller and smaller and smaller. Where does the rubber go? It goes somewhere. Think about all those tires in the country or in the world that people have to keep buying every few years because essentially they get smaller. Where does the rubber go? And the answer is it goes into the air or it becomes dust. Those little particles of rubber just break off and they're very, very small. And then they just coat the environment. And if you live in the city and you have a window that you can open, you will notice this grime that comes through the window. And that's a bunch of different things because cities are a complicated atmospheric environment. But a lot of that grime, that fine dust that's kind of a little greasy and dark, is actually tires. Diesel exhaust too. Yes, lots of particulates with diesel exhaust. Less so now than it used to be. But that's where tires go. After the tires worn out and you get your tires changed and the garage keeps the tires, what do they do with them? They will either sell them or dispose of them depending on what's available. Now, I'm not talking about tires that are slightly worn and they're selling for a used market. We'll skip that. I'm just talking about what do you do with a worn out tire? Well, a lot of them just end up in landfills. Massive, massive piles of tires in landfills, which is a problem because the chemicals can leach into the soil. And a bigger problem to me anyway, one that affects me personally more, is that water can gather up in the tires and mosquitoes can breed there. So this isn't a good thing. So for decades, we've been trying to figure out how do we deal with all these tires? Because there's a lot of them. And somebody came up with the idea of grinding them up, removing all the steel belted parts and using them as mulch, especially in playgrounds, because they create this kind of soft thing that if somebody falls off the playground, they end up in these tires and they last a really long time. And this was great until a particular soccer goalie got brain cancer. And they had in this one place, they had lined the goalie area with these rubber things and they somehow attributed the rubber to the brain cancer. I don't know if that was a legal justification or a scientific one, but putting that aside, that event actually made this less common because people are worried about the shredded tires causing cancer, which is seems a reasonable thing to worry about. I would actually like to know the actual science behind that. So another thing they use it for is to mix in with asphalt to surface roads. And that is also a thing. And then there are many, many minor things. People have made sandals out of tires forever. My dad in the 70s had a pair of sandals that were made out of used tires. People use them to make houses. There's a thing called rammed earth, where you take a bunch of tires and make a wall out of them and you force dirt into them and you end up with this incredibly stable and insulated building that it doesn't sound like a bad idea to me. But I'm afraid that almost all of them now just end up in landfill because that's the cheapest and easiest thing to do. It turns out we have lots of land. You will hear that landfill, oh no, we're running out of landfills locally, but not on a national or even global scale. There's plenty of space to just pile up tires. And all these companies have to do is find a jurisdiction that doesn't care about the environment very much, and they just give a permit, and then they just pile up acres and acres of tires, and eventually that will catch on fire, and there'll be this massive fire, and as you know, tire fires do not go out. They last forever. Anyway, that's what's happening to your tires. And on that note, let's move up a bit. What about the rims? So tires, okay, what about the rims? What happens to the rims? Well, they're steel, and anything steel in a car is typically recycled. There are a lot of car recycling places now, and I've actually seen videos on this and how they do it. It's a very gross process, and by that I don't mean disgusting. I mean it's very not detailed. It's very large scale. They have these machines that will take a car and then take it apart, but by taking it apart, all they're doing is they're removing the engine and the transmission and then basically separating the steel from the plastic in the simplest way possible. It's by no means complete. And all that steel gets recycled. So any of the steel in your vehicle gets recycled. Same is true for the aluminum. Different vehicles have different parts that are aluminum or steel, whatever. So that's actually pretty good. If you go up from there, obviously the body is steel. The inside, you've got the cushions and the seats and all the plastic of the dashboard. That's landfill bound. There's really not much they can do with that. I mean, we van life folks might recycle bits of that. Like, I know some people will find old seats from vans and put them in their vans. Or actually, I've seen people take the seats from their vans and put them in their homes, because why not? That happens. But in a large scale, now that is all landfill bound. And again, a lot of your vehicle is going to end up in the landfill. The electronics, all these fancy screens and stuff, yeah, there's no real recycling or reuse for those. All that ends up in a landfill. Now, what about some of the more esoteric things? For example, diesel. You're burning, you know, in the life of a vehicle, if you burn diesel, you're burning unbelievable amounts of diesel, swimming pools worth of diesel. So it's a liquid, it has substance, and then it's gone. Where does it go? Well, it goes out your tailpipe, almost all of it. I mean, obviously the energy in there powers your vehicle and produces heat. Those are the two places the energy goes. And some sound, but that's negligible. The rest of it all comes out as exhaust, and that goes into the environment and settles down and becomes part of the soil. That is where your diesel's going. Everything that is not caught by the diesel particulate filter, if you have one, yeah, it just ends up in the dirt. And so all that diesel, which comes from oil that we dig out of the ground, becomes dust that ends up in the soil. And that is not a great thing. And that's why we have diesel particulate filters, because when that stuff is in the air before it settles down, it can get into people's lungs and cause cancer. And we see that every year is thousands and thousands of cases of cancer caused by diesel vehicles. But it doesn't affect anybody directly or individually. So we kind of say, oh, well, that's okay. But it isn't okay in my mind. Anyway, separate argument. Gasoline, same thing, although gasoline doesn't have the particulates. Gasoline is a much more volatile substance than diesel. It is aromatic more so than diesel, and it becomes gases that mix with the air. So you're turning a liquid into a gas. There's a little bit of particulate. There's a little bit of carbon. Obviously, there's carbon in all these things, but the carbon doesn't come out as carbon. It comes out as CO2, and that ends up in the air. And sure, CO2 in the air can be a good thing in some ways. Trees can turn it into wood, for example. And that's one of the anti-global warming arguments, is that CO2 is good for the environment. Yeah, well, we don't have to get into that. Let me just say that the science is strongly opposed to that idea, and that some CO2 is good, but a whole lot of CO2 is very, very bad. And that's why if you are living on the coast in Florida, you are having a really hard time getting insurance right now. What about all the oils, right? So you have all this oil, and you change your engine oil every so often, because if you don't, you're really hurting your investment. But you've also got the gear oils and the hydraulic fluid. I mean, there's a lot of oils in there. The brake fluid. Where does all that go? Well, the engine oil will get recycled into something. I'm not exactly sure what they do, but that is not just wasted. That is a hydrocarbon. It is worth something. It is refined back into something else. I should have looked it up. I'm sorry, I didn't. But that I know is recycled. That has some value. So when you change the oil in your car, whether you do it yourself or you go to Jiffy Lube or whatever, you can take the oil in and they will take it and then they actually sell it to somebody who turns it into something else. So that's good. The other fluids, not so much. If you have your brake fluid changed at a dealer, you know, those fluids will also get recycled. But mostly what happens with brake fluid is it leaks. Most of the time, there's that brake fluid in the car that when the car is at its end of its life, that's just it's just they ignore it. They don't pay much attention to it. When they take a car apart, it just leaks on the ground. And that's where it ends up. Same thing with gear oils. Nobody is really recycling the gear oils that are in your car. You know, your rear differentials get gear oil in it. Yeah, if you have that serviced and they suck it out, they will deal with it. But most of the time when the car's at the end of life, they might drain it out. A lot of it's just getting spilled. And imagine if the vehicle catches on fire. Maybe that's the end of its life. All that is just hazardous waste and nobody does anything with it. What about the antifreeze? Well, if you do a flush and fill at a dealership or another auto service place, sure, they're going to recycle that somehow. Again, I don't know where that goes, but an awful lot of antifreeze just ends up on the ground. Accidents, end-of-life vehicles, and that stuff's not great. I mean, it's a big hazard to wildlife. If you ever leave antifreeze laying out in a bowl, for example, wildlife likes it. It's a sweet taste, and dogs and raccoons and things will drink it, and they will die. So you have to treat that stuff carefully. But I don't think very much of it gets recycled. I think, again, that is something that just gets lost in the environment. What about air conditioning? This is a big one. So, you know, when I was a kid, all the vehicles had R12, which is Freon, like truly Freon, and we still call coolants Freons. But that has changed a lot, because when that stuff got in the atmosphere, it would go up into the ozone and just eat it and make big holes in the ozone. You don't hear so much about that anymore. The hole in the ozone was a big, big thing in the 80s. You don't hear about it as much anymore because we did a little bit to fix that. We stopped using Freon as much. Another use for Freon, by the way, was to make styrofoam. It was what they used to actually puff up the plastic, the polystyrene that made styrofoam. And we stopped doing that, and that has helped a lot with the ozone layer. So yay us. Ozone does regenerate. It's a byproduct of UV light hitting oxygen. It adds another oxygen atom to it, so you get instead of O2, you get O3, that's ozone. Anyway, too much detail. But we fixed that by using other refrigerants, and they're not as good, honestly. None of the refrigerants we've found to replace R12 are as good. Cyclopentane, like you have in your refrigerator, or R134A, which I believe just got taken off the list of approved chemicals. Let me look that up real quick, because that's important. Yes, R134A was banned, mostly phased out is a better word, with all new cars starting with 2021. So if you have a newer than 2021 car, it doesn't use R134A anymore. Now it uses R1234YF. I don't know what the difference is, but this is clearly a problem. We are relying more and more on refrigerants, and they are still not a great thing to get into the environment. And that's why when you go have your air conditioning serviced, they're supposed to evacuate the system before they add new stuff. They're supposed to capture all that. And I don't know if they reprocess it or what, but it's not supposed to be just let out into the environment. And yet, that's what happens probably more often than not. At the end of life of a vehicle, the junkyard, you know, are they really going to go through the process of going through every vehicle and sucking out all that refrigerant, or are they just going to poke a hole in it? I don't know. I'm not accusing anybody of anything, but based on the way things work, a lot of times this stuff's getting into the atmosphere. And obviously, if there's an accident, if you had a head-on, then all that refrigerant's instantly in the atmosphere. And don't forget that over time, these things develop leaks. And so every vehicle out there that's ever had an air conditioning recharge has dumped all of that refrigerant into the environment already. So I think a vast majority of these refrigerants, whether they be R12 or R134A or this new 1234YF, yeah, that is all just going into the environment. And while it's impacting the ozone less than it used to, I think it still has an impact. And you have that to be happy about. What about all the glass in your vehicle? All of it is landfill. There's no reusing any of that glass. It's a laminate safety glass or it's tempered glass. They can't even really remelt it and get new glass out of it, because ultimately that doesn't make any sense because, well, quartz, which they make glass out of, quartz sand, is pretty much free. So, you know, the raw materials are not the problem there. So, yeah, all the glass is landfill. Same with all of the interior, basically, all the linings and the plastic and, you know, the carpet, all that, that is all going to landfill. So think about that. I mean, what do you do with this information? I don't know. It's just a perspective thing. So when you're building out your van, you can look around at all the stuff you're putting in there. And if you just take a moment and think, where is this stuff eventually going to end up? Will that alter your decision making? It might. It might not. I don't know. Maybe you'll decide that you want to build with all wood, because at least wood will eventually rot and get back into the soil. But that releases CO2. So that isn't maybe a good... I don't know. There's a lot to think about here, and I'm not making any arguments in any direction. I just wanted folks to take a moment to think about, where does all this stuff end up? Thank you to Michael and all of you who have bought me some gallons at buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. Michael was kind enough to buy me 3 gallons of Flex Seal, which is very nice of him, because, the Tiki Bago is... we're actually talking about getting rid of the Tiki Bago because we don't use it anymore and it's becoming a pain to maintain. So the 3 gallons of Flex Seal is very, very welcome there. Thank you, Michael. I appreciate it. And to everyone who donates with buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go, you are keeping ads off this podcast. So all of you, especially those of you who do this every month, are making a difference in the lives of everybody who listens. And I think that's great. So thank you all. If you'd like to be part of this, buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And that is the end of the ads for the show. Van life news. Okay, big news. This is actually legitimately big news in a big picture sort of way. And a lot of people have sent me this. Terry and Brian, thank you for sending this to me, and a few others sent it too. The Volkswagen camper van is coming back to the U.S. And that has been something, the ID buzz and people, blah, blah, blah. No. Stop everything. This is not the hype talking. This is the actual Volkswagen is making a camper van that is being sold in the U.S. And this hasn't happened for decades. This isn't aftermarket. This isn't, they make a cutaway and somebody builds it. No. This is Volkswagen itself producing camper vans just like they used to do. All those Westphalias out there and everybody who loves them, well, something like that is coming back. It's a package that is being added to the ID Buzz, which left the U.S., if you remember, and now it's coming back. And that's right, this is an electric van. It's electric. You're probably thinking, okay, well, that all sounds great, but as we see this trend going, this is going to cost $100,000, right? Well, no, that's one of the interesting things. They did not sell very many ID Buzzes in the U.S., less than 10,000, significantly less than 10,000, and that's why they dropped it. So they did some research, and apparently they figured out that it was the price point. And the real pricing hasn't been announced yet. But the prediction, and you can read the article here, it's from newatlas.com, but the prediction is $60,000 to $65,000. Again, not inexpensive. But when you look at the cost of even the cheapest Winnebago van, this is a bargain. Now, it's electric, and that is good and bad. That's a new way of thinking about things, and you have to be comfortable with that. It's a Volkswagen. I'm not a big fan of German cars based on past experience, but that is up to you. And, it's going to be small, and it's probably going to be very simple. But they are getting the range of that thing up to 234 miles, which is certainly enough to take trips with. And as chargers increase across the country, which I think they're doing, there's arguments both ways on that, this becomes a very viable way to just, turnkey, go to the dealership, buy a camper van, and hit the road in a classic vehicle. So, yeah, link in the show notes, but this was from New Atlas, and it's called VW and Reinvigorates U.S. Van Life with First New Camper Van in Decades. We'll see about the Reinvigorates U.S. Van Life part, but, new camper van, first in decades, yeah, that's accurate. On a not even close to similar note, somebody made a van life horror movie. It's called Passenger, and I have not seen it, but apparently it is full of jump scares, and, well, if you would like to learn what the horrors of van life are like through the eyes of Hollywood, you're welcome to do that. I have a link in the show notes from slashfilm.com, but Passenger, the van life horror movie, I'll see it eventually. I'll talk about it when I do, but, I mean, it's kind of funny, because I'm sure... I'm not sure. I'm imagining it's a Friday the 13th style slasher pick or something like that. But I'm thinking you could actually make a really good comedy van life horror movie about the real horrors of van life. Like, your composting toilet has maggots in it, and your milk has gone bad yet again, and you don't know why because your refrigerator seems to be at the right temperature. I don't know. Anyway, I like to keep things a little bit more real, I guess. Back to electric vans for a second. The BrightDrop. We've talked about this before. BrightDrop was a promising electric van that seems to have been dropped. Well, somebody built one out, and as I said, there's a guy in Chicago I see all the time. I haven't been able to talk to him yet, but this guy built this thing called the Gus Bus, and he's doing it, folks. He has built this electric van out of a BrightDrop. He's got everything you can think of in an electric van, and he's doing it at a time when gas prices are ginormous, and he doesn't have to think about that so much. So if you'd like to learn more about how someone has actually made their electric van dreams come true, well, Gus has done it. And I have the link here from AutoEvolution.com. Title is Gus Bus Proves That All Electric Van Life Is All It's Cracked Up To Be. So that might be worth a look if you're interested in that kind of stuff. Tech Talk. You will know very quickly that I am not sponsored by K&N Filters, because I'm about to tell you that you shouldn't buy them. I'm not, of course, not sponsored by them or anybody else. No, K&N Filters, don't buy them. That's the bottom line. I could end it right there. The truth of the matter is that when you do the research, the filters that come with your vehicle, the paper filters that you're supposed to change every so often, are finely tuned to be the best possible air filter that you can get for your vehicle. And if you're not familiar with this concept of the oiled cleanable air filter, the idea is that it gives you more performance and more gas mileage in your engine. And is that true? Well, in some cases for highly tuned engines, like a sports car, a K&N filter will give you more horsepower and even maybe a little bit better gas mileage, which are two things that are in opposition to each other. But the way they do that is bad. It's bad. Do you know how you can do that? Well, you can do that with your vehicle right now. Open air filter housing. See that paper air filter in there? Poke a bunch of holes in it. Or just throw it out. That will instantly increase your miles per gallon and your horsepower and drastically shorten the life of your vehicle. Basically, what these K&N filters were doing was letting more air in. And the way they did that was they made the little holes bigger, and that lets more dust in. And the whole point of the air filter is to keep dust out of your engine, because the dust gets in your engine and it gets into the cylinders, and little tiny, tiny, tiny particles of dust add wear to the cylinders and then wears out your engine quickly. That's what the air filter's for. And it's a careful balancing that engineers have spent countless hours on figuring out what size filters to make to keep the dust out but to let the air in, because more air is better for your engine. Also, the placement of the air filter is important. You want, in most cases, cold air or colder air to be going in there, not the warm air from the engine. So if you look at how your air filter's placed, it's almost always in a place where it's getting air not near the heat of the engine. I mean, heck, you can look at big trucks. And you see the air filters like mounted on the side of the cab in some cases. It's not even in the engine compartment. That's why. So, like many of these things, oh, if you just buy this product, your vehicle will run so much better. You know, put these magnets on your gas thing or pour in this Teflon into the oil. All that stuff, you have to consider that the engineers who designed this vehicle have done everything they could to maximize profit. That's their goal. But the way to maximize profit for them is to make the best vehicle performance possible for the price. So if they could change the air filter for $20 or whatever and get more mileage or more performance, they absolutely would do that. And if K&N or any other brand's filters performed better than the ones they could make, they would switch. They would. And they do. I mean, that's what we see. Anytime an innovation happens, it gets spreads out to all vehicles because it genuinely works. I mean, that's why we've got turbochargers, and that's why we've got coolant reservoirs instead of just the radiator. I mean, all these little things that people have learned over 100 years of making engines, it's all in there. And it's unlikely that any company is going to come up with this one quick thing that's going to fix anything. And that certainly applies to K&N filters. So when you're buying an air filter, which is an important component of your vehicle, you do want to pay attention to it. The OEM is fine. It's probably, quote unquote, the best, but it's often exactly the same as something else you can get for less money. So do a little bit of research on your vehicle. Don't get the cheapest air filter possible, because some of them are actually garbage. Get a reasonable air filter from a well-known brand. Talk to your auto parts place. Make sure they don't try to sell you a K&N filter. And that's all you need to do. Smart, smart people have put a lot of work into this, and there's no reason not to trust them. Product review. Battery banks, little battery banks, like the ones that fit in your pocket, you know, they're everywhere. And I've got a whole bunch of them. You probably have a whole bunch of them too. But the truth is, it's now time to start getting rid of them. The older ones that you've had for 10 years, like, for example, I bought one in 2016. I was going on a trip to Africa. I wasn't sure what kind of power I was going to have, so I wanted a big bank. I bought this big, I don't know what it is, 10,000 milliamp hour battery. And I used it, and it was great. And had two USB ports, and it charged with another one, and I really no complaints about it. But it is a lithium ion battery, not LiFePO4, not lithium iron phosphate. The problem is that lithium ion batteries are much more dangerous. If they get damaged, they are much more likely to combust and cause all these fires that you hear about. Lithium iron phosphate can do that too, but it's much more likely with lithium ion. And in my opinion, it's time to start phasing those out of your life. I have a bunch of them. I do. My first two power banks that I bought, my solar generators, are lithium ion technology, and I have stopped keeping them in vehicles, and I'll keep them outside vehicles. I'll still use them if I'm sitting outside, but they are, you know, kind of watched. Whereas my Jackery, which is lithium iron phosphate, I don't care. I'm not as worried about that. So what do you replace them with? Well, anything, really. But I bought one for a trip I took to, where did I go with this? Oh, yeah, Royal Clipper. That's right. Royal Clipper, anyway. Royal Clipper has some interesting power requirements, so I wanted a battery bank. So I bought this one that's a little weird, and I thought I'd talk about it and tell you about its performance and everything. And this is one of 8 million options that you have. This one's made by a company called Rory, R-O-R-R-Y. And yes, it's just a Chinese company that came up with a fake name because they need to distinguish themselves somehow. But it's got an interesting feature. This one is specifically useful for people who have Apple Watches, because on the outside of the battery, it's about the size of an ice cream sandwich. Hey, I'm American. I'm not allowed to use actual units. I have to come up with a direct comparison. So it's about the size of an ice cream sandwich, a little smaller, rounded on the edges. And on one side, there is an Apple Watch charger just built into the case. You just stick, you just put your Apple Watch right on there. You can strap it down to keep it in place, but it is magnetic. And if you just set it down, it'll sit there. So you don't have to worry about a cable or an extra charger for your Apple Watch. It's built into the battery. And then you can just use that as your Apple Watch charger for an entire trip, because, you know, you're going to plug in the battery eventually. It works that way too, or not, you know, or you can just use it off the battery. Apple Watches don't use all that much power. So that's a kind of a nice bonus for a traveler. The other really big bonus that it has is that it has two prongs that fold out, and you can just plug it into an outlet. You don't have to hook it up with a cable. As long as you have a US plug, and I'm sure they make them for other countries too, you just plug it in and that's how it charges, or it acts as a charger. It's kind of both a battery and a charger. I did try it with European outlets, and yeah, I was able to use the little adapter, and even though it was kind of awkward because you have this heavy thing hanging out, it worked just fine. Also, it has a built-in USB-C cable. It just has one there, so you can plug this into the wall and charge your iPhone or your Android phone and your Apple Watch without needing any cables. It's all built in. It's actually pretty, pretty useful. It does not have a flashlight, which is fine, but a lot of these have flashlights. This one does not. It does have a crazy bright LED screen, which honestly caused me some trouble at night when I was trying to sleep because the thing was so bright. But, you know, that's pretty easy to handle. And that's it. It's just very simple, fits in your pocket, and I got a lot of use out of it, and I'm very happy I bought it. I paid like $35. I think it's a little bit more expensive than that now. And it's, you know, it's full capacity, 10,000 milliamp hours, easily enough to charge your phone or even your laptop these days, especially if you have like a Mac Air or one of those new Mac Neos. It'll charge that up at least once. It's a nice little battery. I recommend it. Now, it's not unique. There's many, many others like this. So think about it. This is time to start thinking about replacing those lithium ion batteries. Also, just a side note, there's a new rule that when you're flying now, if you have these batteries, you're not allowed to put them in your carry-on luggage. Now, you knew you couldn't put them in your check-on bags. Now you can't put them in your carry-ons. You have to have them on your person, meaning either in your pocket or in a vest pocket or something like that. And this is important, you're not allowed to use them on the plane, which is a bit annoying because not all planes have USB charging or any charging. Southwest, for example, has nothing. So that's kind of a bummer, but that is the new rules. This battery, as cool as it is, you can't use on an airplane, and you actually can't use any on airplanes anymore. So anyway, there's the Rory Flow portable charger, 10,000 milliamp hours, 40 watts fast charger. I didn't mention that, but it is a fast charger. It charges very quickly with everything built in. I got the pink one. And they actually have two pink ones. They have a soft pink and a hot pink one. And the reason I got the pink one is it's a little cheaper. For some reason, the pink one is a couple dollars cheaper. And, well, I don't care. So it's pink. Who cares? Some people like pink. Tales from the Road. So this tale is still in the making, and I just want to share this amazing thing that my friend Joe is doing. So I was at Tiki Bagelland last weekend, and I got a text message saying, hey, where are you? What are you doing? And I was like, oh, I think I was repairing a tractor at the time. And it turns out my friend Joe from Denver, Colorado, was driving across country, and he thought I was in Chicago, and I was like, no, I'm down here in LaSalle County. And it turns out he was going to drive right by, because where I am in LaSalle County is it's Interstate 39, Interstate 80, where they cross, and he was driving on Interstate 80. So we're like, hey, let's meet up. And I don't have a lot of time. And I was like, okay, sure. And we talked about it, and said, I really would like to meet up somewhere where there's a supercharger. And, well, the Hy-Vee supermarket in Peru, Illinois, is a couple miles from the interstate. And, they've got a massive bank of Tesla superchargers. And so we meet him there. And my wife is with me, Jen. And we're just, basically saying hi. Joe is a great guy. Don't get to spend enough time with him. Been on a few trips with him, but a very thoughtful guy with a very interesting past. And what he's doing is super interesting. He is driving to every state in the country on self-driving, full self-driving. He's in a Tesla Model Y. And he's basically doing this just to do it, just to see if it can be done, to learn about the experience. He's already been to all the states, so for him, that is not a new bucket list. He's already seen them all. But he's trying to come up with the most efficient route by which the car can drive itself to all of the 48 contiguous states. And he's gone through several already. And I just thought, that's a really interesting idea. And the reason I'm mentioning this for van life is that he's treating his Model Y kind of like a van. He's sleeping in it. He's doing basically everything in it. Now, he will probably stay in hotels and stuff. He's not going to, totally sleep in the Model Y the entire time. But he is absolutely doing this all in the Model Y on self-driving. Now, I have not driven, I've actually never driven a Tesla at all, and I've certainly never experienced self-driving. But from everybody that I talk to, it is amazing at how much it reduces driving fatigue. I mean, what fatigue? You're sitting in the seat and you turn the wheel a little bit. Yeah, no, there is fatigue associated with that. It's attentional fatigue. You are using up resources as you're driving, and while they may not be physical in a strength way, just those little adjustments of the wheel and constantly scanning the horizon and stuff does take time from you. And that is reduced substantially with these self-driving cars. Now, the thing is, people are afraid of this idea. They're afraid of losing control. Like, why should I trust this car and all its robots and computers to not smash into something else? Well, you trust it the same way you trust other people not to do that. I mean, think about it. Every time you go around a curve and then there's another car coming towards you, it's about 3 degrees of steering wheel preventing you guys from smashing into each other. So you are trusting every other driver on the road, and, they can't be trusted. A lot of those other drivers cannot be trusted. In fact, for me, looking at statistics, the self-driving cars appear to be much safer than the other drivers on the road. Now, that's statistics and analysis type 2 thinking, if you want to call it that. The emotional response is, I don't have any control, this thing's driving and I can't stand it. Except that's not how it is. When we're in full self-driving mode, you can take control anytime you want. It's not like the car's going to fight you for control of the steering wheel or anything like that. In fact, the car makes sure that you're paying attention, that you have a hand on the wheel, etc., in case something comes across that it can't deal with. I have driven cars with limited self-driving, and I got used to it very, very quickly. And when I got back to my cars that do not have anything like this at all, it was interesting how, oh, I have to think about this now. I have to pay attention to staying in the middle of the lane and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, I thought this was a great idea. Joe is not doing anything social media-wise with this yet. He's still thinking about what to do about it. But I thought it was just a fascinating thing to do. He's hoping to get it done in 2 weeks. And I'll let you know how it goes once I hear from him. But you looking for something to do in your van? Well, maybe something like this will be right up your alley. A place to visit. I've talked about this before, but I want to talk about it again. Because of all the museums that Chicago has to offer, there's one that's easily overlooked. And it really, really shouldn't be. It was formerly called the Oriental Institute, and it's near the Chicago University of Chicago in Hyde Park, which is on the south side of Chicago. And you can get there from downtown. You take the electric line from Millennium Park, and it will take you down there on the train. You can't get there on the L, but it's not a big deal. And what it is, and I kid you not, you're going to think this is hyperbole, but it isn't. This is the museum that Indiana Jones worked at. Now, let me explain. Indiana Jones was a fictional character, but he was based on a real person. The guy's name was James Henry Breasted, and he created it in 1919 with money from John D. Rockefeller, back in the days when billionaires actually, you know, supported public good. And he was the first American to get a PhD in Egyptology, and he traveled to the Near East and Egypt and studied things at a time when that was huge, because Tutankhamun was discovered and everything. And as was the practice of the time, hello, British Museum, brought a whole bunch of stuff back with him. And that may be controversial, and I understand that. But the stuff is there, and it's a lot of stuff, and it's amazing stuff. And some of it is like, how did he get that back here? It's really, really big. And it's basically a museum on Egyptology and the surrounding regions, you know, the Near East. And, yeah, he's not Indiana Jones, but Indiana Jones was based on him. In fact, so much so that when somebody sent a package to Indiana Jones in the mail, the post office delivered it to the Oriental Institute. Now, it's not called that anymore, probably because the word Oriental has gotten a nasty tinge to it based on how some people refer to other people. And while the word is fine in this context, they've decided to change the name, and they changed it to the Institute for the Study of Ancient Cultures, which is totally fine, except that it's very focused on a specific region and time period of ancient cultures. I actually organized an event here for Atlas Obscura way back in the day, and it was a blast. This is just such a cool museum. And now, I haven't been in a while, and I hope it's still true. But there is a gift shop. I know, shocking. But the gift shop did something really interesting. It actually sold artifacts. Now, I don't mean artifacts that were of huge historic importance. I mean things that were mass-produced back in the day, but were still old, you know, still hundreds of years old, not thousands. And you could just buy them. And I bought this leather-wrapped prayer thing. It's kind of hard to explain. It's this little tube, and inside I'm told there's a scroll that has a specific prayer on it, and you're supposed to wear it like a necklace. And it was a prescription prayer for whatever ailment you had, and I don't know anything else about it, but I thought that was kind of a cool thing that you could actually buy a little bit of history like that. And again, I don't think, you know, that belongs in a museum applies to things that are mass-produced like that. There are some in museums. They're well-studied, but there's enough of these that, yeah, anyone can have one. Kind of like trilobites, you know? Trilobites also belong in museums, but they can also be in your private collection because there's so many of them. Anyway, Chicago, city of great museums, the Art Institute, of course, the Field Museum, of course, and whatever the new name is of the Museum of Science and Industry, all amazing places to visit. In fact, this is not too far from the Museum of Science and Industry. go there. Locals will probably still call it the Oriental Institute, the same way we still have the Sears Tower in Kaminsky Park. But I pretty much don't have Kaminsky Park anymore, but you'll hear it referenced still. But this is definitely a place that if you are coming to Chicago, even just for a couple days, it is well worth visiting. I have a link in the show notes from the Atlas Obscura article about the Institute. I cannot overstate how much more of a museum it is than I'm making it sound. The stuff they have there is incredible, and it's the stuff that you're not going to see anywhere except in a traveling exhibition or in Egypt itself. Very cool place, even if you're just an Indiana Jones fan. Resource recommendation. Hey, a couple of fun little things here. First, some of you have written to me and told me that the game Outbound is alive, and it's true. Outbound is a van life game where you build out your van and you get resources and you can build things and explore. It's called a cozy game, but it is a van life game. Instead of actually doing van life, you can play a game of van life, which, you know, in some cases that might be all you can do, or you just think it's fun. Whatever, I don't care. But it looks like a lot of fun. I'm linking to a review of it that has some gameplay so you can see how it is. And the graphics remind me of Firewatch, if you remember that game, where you're out in the environment exploring and nothing's too incredibly detailed, but it's also not really cartoony either. I like it. I have not played it yet, so this is not an official review for me. I'm just trying to make you aware that it is out. So that is the game called Outbound. And another game that hasn't quite come out yet is a lot more straightforward. It's called Van Life Simulator. And the game is supposed to simulate van life. So not only do you build out your van, you have to go do van life things. And this one's even more of, I want to do van life, but I don't actually want to do it, so I'll play a video game of doing it. Which in some contexts is good. You know, I don't actually want to grab a bunch of guns and run into a building and kill everybody, but video games are like that, you know? I'm going to just leave that there and move on. Anyway, these look like fun, and when I get a chance to play them, I will, and I will talk about them some more. But you've got two games here. The Van Life Simulator, which is not out yet. I have a link to Steam where you can wishlist that or whatever. And then Outbound, which is actually out, and you can play right now. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 296. Thanks, as always, to Simon Wagg for providing the music. If you would like to get a hold of me, you can get me at jeff@built2go.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. Or at built2go.com, where you can find links to our Facebook group and our Discord server. Until next time, remember the words of Dwight D. Eisenhower, who said, "In preparing for battle, I have always found plans useless. But planning, indispensable."